Dear friends, it's a great pleasure to share the history of Christian interpretation of Sarah and Hagar with you today. It's been really lots of interesting, as Claire said, there's lots of interesting stuff I learned as well. I thought I knew my scriptures, but there was lots of stuff that I still had to learn. But I thought I'd start with a question to particularly the Christian members of this group. I suppose there are several of us here. How often, within, let's say, the last year, have you heard within your Christian communities or households Sarah and Hagar being discussed? Not very often, yeah. Ever? Ever? Are they ever discussed? Yeah, I would be very pleasantly surprised if they were. So I thought probably that could have been the end of my Christian presentation. But maybe I'm enjoying this too much, so I'll just take my time and continue on. So yeah, before I started preparing for this talk, I also knew much less, and I've learned a lot, so thank you. But then, of course, those Christians who know their scriptures, would definitely have heard about Abraham and his two partners, because they are mentioned in the Christian scriptures. Of course, there is the story of Abraham, Sarah, and Hagar, as described in the Hebrew Bible, as Jenny read to us, which is also the Christian scripture. But there is also a passage that discusses Sarah and Hagar and Abraham in the Christian New Testament. And I will read that particular passage to you. It's found in Paul's letter to Galatians, chapter 4, and I quote, "For it is written that Abraham had two sons, one by a slave woman and one by a free woman. But the son of the slave was born according to the flesh, while the son of the free woman was born through promise. Now this may be interpreted allegorically. These women are two covenants. One is from Mount Sinai, bearing children for slavery. She is Hagar. Now Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia. She corresponds to the present Jerusalem, for she is in slavery with her children. But the Jerusalem above is free, and she is our mother." End of quote. So this is a text from the Christian scriptures. Most Christians would consider this text to be inspired, revered, and followed. Of course, it is taken out of a specific context, and the context is Paul's quarrel with Christian leaders who differed from him on the matter of Christian circumcision. But as we know, in religious tradition, we are encouraged to take wisdom from a specific context and apply it to a wider range of situations. We like looking for patterns, and here is one that Paul has provided. And Paul's meaning in Galatians 4 is quite unmistakable. There are two ways of having a relationship with God, like a slave or like a free person. Slaving to God involves what he calls fleshly work, following some strictly set rules. Following God like a free person involves following a promise, not through works, but through faith alone. You, says Paul, to his audience, the Christians, are free people. In the allegory that he provides, it means that the Christians are the children of Sarah, children of the promise. And of course, Paul would only imagine to identify himself with the children of Sarah, not Hagar. After all, he was a Jew, a very well-educated Jew, he lived and breathed Jewish teaching and tradition. But his audience were Christians of no Jewish origin. So by identifying the Christians as the children of Sarah, Paul showed these non-Jewish Christians how to disown the Jews of their heritage. Not only did he claim that Sarah is not an ancestor for the Jews, he even identified the Jews as descendants of Hagar, something that is clearly against the text of the Jewish Bible. It is, by the way, worth noting that there were no Muslims at the time of Paul, nor any other known religious group that identified themselves as descendants of Hagar. So Paul did not specifically offend any other religious group in that regard, but his move against the Jews, unfortunately, was unmistakable. Also, it is worth noting that Paul has no interest in the two women per se, and their situation in this particular passage. The question for him is only about the offspring. Which one is superior, better, the ruler of the other kind? There are a couple of other passages in the New Testament that do mention Sarah, not Hagar. This is the only passage in the New Testament that mentions Hagar. But there are passages that talk more about Sarah, how the authors saw her as a woman. In the letter to the Hebrews, she is praised for her faith. In 1 Peter, we read that she is an example for a good Christian wife when she submits herself to her husband. She is also an example to all Christian women, as she was beautiful in the inner self rather than outwardly. So Sarah is certainly favored by the authors of the New Testament texts. They identified themselves with her in the Sarah Hagar story. And they and their successors used Sarah's superiority in order to claim their own superiority against other religious groups that claimed the same scriptural heritage. Above all, Paul's letter to Galatians was used particularly widely in affirming Christian superiority of Jews. And it is a very uncomfortable aspect of this story at a Jewish Christian Muslim forum like this. But I think as Christians, we have to face the demons of our past so that we can recognize them in our present. So knowingly or unknowingly, with his allegory of Sarah and Hagar, in the letter to the Galatians, Paul had provided numerous medieval Christian rulers with ideological justification for oppression of Jews and Muslims. In 1095, Pope Urban II reportedly used Sarah's invocation, cast out the slave woman and her son, to galvanize Christians for the First Crusade. And Pope Innocent III in the early 12th century used Paul's allegory to urge the expulsion of Jews from Christian lands. We need to acknowledge that there is a strong tradition in our interpretive history that exalts Sarah and vilifies Hagar. Sarah is praised as an upright wife and church father Origen. Augustine calls her the heavenly city of grace and divine mercy. And Hagar is everything opposite. She's rebellious, in love with things temporal and earthly. Chrysostom, another church father, portrays Sarah as sensible and with an astonishing self-control, a true philosopher. Whereas Hagar is full of passion and impulse, something that would be distasteful for somebody who was a monk and a philosopher himself. So I think if there was a contest between Sarah and Hagar on who is more popular and favored, Sarah was definitely winning it with the early church fathers and the medieval Christian commentators. However, the world has always been another thread in their understanding of Hagar in Christian Bible commentaries and theologies. For example, that same John Chrysostom shows sympathy for Hagar in some of his writing. He talks about God's compassion for her and care for her. But it was only around the time of the Reformation when we see more pronounced change in the interpretation. Bible commentators became much more interested in Hagar as a person and started identifying themselves with her and her story. This change can be illustrated from the writings of the great reformer Martin Luther in late 16th century. He does talk about Hagar as a symbol of Islam and uses her to condemn Turks, these day Muslims, of his. So that way continuing the tradition of Christian writers before him. He also, like the earlier church leaders, talks about Hagar as a person with qualities that no good Christians would follow, like haughtiness and pride. However, Luther goes beyond labeling Hagar as the anti-hero. What is particularly important for him is Hagar's development, her change during the story. In her affliction, writes Luther, Hagar learned to trust God and changed her destiny. Luther goes so far as to declare that most of us are like Hagar. We all display pride and are led to faith and repentance. In his commentary to Genesis 16, Luther writes, and I quote, "They certainly conclude that Hagar should be counted among the saintly women," end of quote. Empathy for Hagar's cause, her exile in the wilderness, and the direct revelation from God appears in literature, particularly in art, around the same time, particularly in the 17th century Dutch Golden Age paintings and drawings. We can talk about the reasons for this change later, but I want to jump to the middle, late 20th century, because it took that long for Hagar to really receive a proper spotlight from Christian thinkers. Some of these commentaries came from African American writers. For example, American Presbyterian theologian and Professor Dolores Williams, who in her book Sisters in the Wilderness recognized Hagar as a biblical character who shared many characteristics with African American women. They're all African. Hagar being Egyptian. They all were involved in sexual surrogacy. They were all used within the household, but they all showed this amazing strength in the face of suffering. Similar elevation Hagar received from the 20th century feminist theologians and biblical commentators. Hagar was finally given that center stage in those circles of Christian thinkers who considered these themes. The best known example of this move is the work by Phyllis Trible, an American Bible scholar and influential feminist Bible critic. She published a chapter of Hagar in her influential book Texts on Terror in 1984. With this work, Trible truly turned the traditional Christian interpretation of Sarah and Hagar upside down. In her analysis, Trible goes well beyond Sarah Hagar dichotomy. She points out how Sarah abuses her power over Hagar, but also seriously questions Abraham's role and motives in this drama. She also lays blame on God, who works to keep Hagar in an abusive relationship. Hagar, however, is completely blameless because she's a victim. However, even though God clearly is with Hagar in her affliction, by the way, much more than God has ever been with Sarah, Trible points out that the ending of Hagar's story is not happy. Was she ever redeemed? Did she ever find peace? Trible ends her commentary on Hagar with an allegory comparing Hagar's fate to that of Israel's pilgrimage of faith, but only through contrast. And I quote, "As a maid in bondage, she flees from suffering. Yet she experiences exodus without liberation, revelation without salvation, wilderness without covenant, wanderings without land, promise without fulfillment, and unmerited exile without return. This Egyptian slave woman is stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted for all the transgressions of Israel. She is bruised for the iniquities of Sarah and Abraham. Upon her is the chastisement that makes them old. Hagar is Israel, from exodus to exile, yet with differences. And these differences yield terror. All we who are heirs of Sarah and Abraham, by flesh and spirit, must answer for the terror in Hagar's story. To neglect the theological challenge she presents is to falsify faith. End of quote. So we have come a whole circle with Tribble allegorically pronouncing Hagar as Israel. But what a difference in this pronunciation from that of Paul's. Here it is all about Hagar, leaving Sarah and Abraham in the shadows. So had Hagar won her contest with Sarah? And then James writes, with the conflict between Sarah and Hagar, described in Genesis, quote, lingers in the history of interpretation, which has typically chosen sides between Sarah and Hagar, favoring one and neglecting or condemning the other, end of quote. But I ask, does it really need to be that way? Because I would suggest that in Christian sphere, actually has space and meaning for both of them. We need to look up to Sarah, who embodies, among other things, divinely established order and human initiatives. We need to look up to Hagar, who among other things has shown divine revelations and perseverance in the face of difficulties. And I think as Christians, we have a good example of how to hold them both together. We will do it shortly as we will celebrate our Christmas story, and we'll remember the beautiful union of the pregnant Mary and the pregnant Elizabeth. And I think in this union, Hagar and Sarah will be reconciled. Because our world and our faith need the birth. We just have to learn how to hold and honor that together.
Behind you if you had an aha moment during